When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I am Joe McCormick. And hey, we are back with part two of our series on cave ecosystems and hypogean biology, cave biology. In the last episode, we talked about some of the characteristic features of cave ecosystems. And then we ended up discussing how lightless cave environments shaped the evolution of a creature called Astyanax mexicanus, or the blind Mexican cave fish, also known as the Mexican tetra, of which many populations have adapted to life in subterranean waterways by losing their eyes and the pigments in their flesh. We ended up kind of doing a deep dive on the evolutionary logic of this. Why an animal population that once had eyes and skin pigment would adapt over many generations to lose those traits in a cave. So if you haven't heard part one yet, you should probably go back and check that one out first. But we are back again today to talk about some more elements of cave biology. Specifically, one of the things I wanted to get into, we didn't really have time for last time, was something else about blind Mexican cave fish, which is if they have no sight, what do they do? How do they navigate their environment and forage for food?
And this is key because, like, they've got to eat something. And these are extreme environments that are generally regarded as not being the most bountiful places to scrape out a livelihood as an organism.
Right. And there might be some advantages to living in the cave if you are a fish like this. Like, there might be fewer predators than you would encounter in the world above. But there are also fewer food resources. So you have to kind of like shift your specialization.
Yeah. Like, if I was to decide, again, this is a non-evolutionary example, but if I was to decide, I am going to now live in my local IKEA store. Well, you know, I've got to figure out some new things, right? It's going to be easy to find a bed when the lights go out, but I'm going to have to deal with the night security. My diet is going to consist entirely of IKEA food.
So, hope you like lingonberry.
Yep. Make sure you don't have a lingonberry allergy for sure.
So I wanted to explore this question of how do blind cave fish sense their surroundings? And so I was looking into this and I discovered that apparently one major sense mechanism that they rely on is what's known as the lateral line system. And this is not a sense that is unique to blind cave fish. The lateral line system is found in lots of aquatic vertebrates, even those that can see, though in blind fish, there are usually enhancements to this system. So it's a sense that they already have, but it gets stronger in the cave evolved variants. As a side note, I always really enjoy imagining types of senses that humans don't have, like what it would be like to have a different kind of sense, you know, like electroreception or magnetic perception or something like that. And this sense in particular, I'm very excited to try to imagine because it's very spooky. Trying to imagine it. It's something about it feels almost kind of Halloween-y. This might make more sense once I explain it. So the basic function of the lateral line system is to detect movements in the water surrounding the animal through high sensitivity to changes in water pressure. This system, it runs along the length of an animal like a fish. So there will be sort of canals of the lateral line sensing organs around the head of the fish and then running lengthwise along the body. The system uses sensory organs known as neuromasts, which contain little hairs suspended within a kind of jelly-filled capsule that bends in response to changes in water pressure and flow. And then these little hairs are connected to nerve cells that are strung along the lateral line system, like Christmas tree lights. Sometimes the neuromasts are exposed to the water on the outside of the skin. They're just right on the outside of the skin. But other times they are contained within a kind of duct or canal that is just under the surface of the skin. And either way, the purpose of the lateral line system is to detect vibrations, movements, and objects within the water by sensing these little changes in water pressure and flow. So with this system, an animal can get feedback about its own movement through the water, for one thing, but it can also sense the presence of currents and nearby solid masses, either moving or stationary, by the way they displace water as the fish moves through it. And this is coming back to what I was saying a minute ago. Something about trying to imagine this is, it's very evocative and a little bit scary almost. So imagining living in a place of dark water, but you can sense objects around you by the way they move the water or by the way they change how the water moves around you.
Oh, wow. I mean, we're getting right back into that Gollum territory. You know, I'm imagining Gollum sensing that goblin that has come down and is washing its hands in the water and so forth on this lightless underground lake. And to your point, it is so alien to try and imagine this. I'm in the water a fair amount. I swim laps most mornings. I was swimming this morning, and it's still, you know, it's a very visual exercise. You can feel things in the water, obviously. You can, and Lord knows there's a lot to see and feel in a YMCA pool. You know, there are people doing exercise classes, there are, you know, people swimming laps next to you, sometimes very often in the same lane with you. And you pick up on those movements, but nowhere near this level of detail. You know, this is like compared to what we have, this is like a second sight.
Yeah, a kind of ghostly vision through which you can sense things around you by the way they move the water against your body. Ooh.
Yeah.
So anyway, the Astyanax fish, the Mexican blind cave fish, apparently compensate for their lack of vision by having a more sensitive lateral line system than their surface-dwelling cousins, and this helps them navigate, forage, and survive in their lightless environment. But this way of living depends not just on heightened sensitivity to water displacement, but also on changes to behavior. For example, one thing I was reading about is when preparing to mate, apparently male and female blind cave fish engage in this in these patterns of exaggerated movements of various body parts, like the mouth and the gills. And these movements are thought to perhaps help the mating partners find and identify one another without visual cues. Does that make sense? Like moving around in the water more so that they can locate one another.
Yeah.
Of course, the fish also have changes to their metabolism to allow them to survive in a place where food is less abundant than it is on the surface. So they are thought to have slower metabolisms, to need less food energy. But also, I was reading about an interesting 2017 study published in PLOS One by some researchers associated with the University of Cincinnati. And this was on the role of asymmetry in blind cavefish evolution. We actually did a whole series on asymmetry in animals a while back in which we talked about fiddler crabs and such, you know, fiddler crabs having one claw much, much bigger than the other. But we talked about a lot of examples in the animal world, and I remember that being a very interesting series.
Yeah, that was a fun one for sure. You know, with the, some of the outrageous examples and some of the less obvious examples of asymmetry.
Apparently, there is a bit of hidden asymmetry in the blind Mexican cavefish as well. So let's see. This study was by Amanda K. Powers, Aaron M. Davis, Shane A. Kaplan, and Joshua B. Gross, published in PLOS One in 2017, and it was called Cranial Asymmetry Arises Later in the Life History of the Blind Mexican Cavefish, Astyanax mexicanus. And so we were talking in the previous episode about how in some of these cavefish populations, the fish are not without eyes from the very beginning. Rather, they do grow eyes initially in embryonic development, but then the eyes go through what's called regression, where they are absorbed and disappear as the fish grows, and then the bone around the eye socket collapses in by the time the fish is an adult. Young cavefish apparently start life with fairly symmetrical bodies, and the surface variants in the rivers above where there's plenty of light also have fairly symmetrical bodies, even as adults. But the young cavefish start out fairly symmetrical, and then as they mature, a mismatch develops in how the bones on either side of their skull take shape. And this asymmetry in their cranial bones seems to match a difference in behavior between the cave variant of the tetras and the surface variant that still has eyes. The surface variant, when you place it in a fish tank, will swim in more random patterns or will just kind of float without moving in the shaded portions of the tank. The cave variant, on the other hand, will just keep, it'll keep swimming in circles around the edges of its tank. And this matches with the fact that has been observed in the wild. In its natural environment, the cave variant will tend to follow the rocky walls of the pool where it lives, swimming counterclockwise around these boundaries in an endless loop. And one of the study's authors, Amanda Powers, was quoted in a press release about the research explaining, quote, "You could see how asymmetry might be an advantage in navigation. They tend to swim in a unidirectional circular motion around their tanks to explore their surroundings. Having asymmetry in their skull, we think, is attributed to handedness. If their skull is bent to the left, they could be right-handed. They're feeling the wall to the right with their sensory structures."
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it seems that the cavefish have a type of developmental handedness that correlates to a navigation behavior where they follow the walls of their natural enclosure in this slow counterclockwise lapping motion. Though I think it's still not fully understood how this system emerges. If it helps them survive, how? We don't fully know yet, but it's interesting to imagine why. And another interesting sort of unrelated thing that I was just reading in this press release, also quoting the same author of the paper, Amanda Powers, talking about how she and colleagues went into the caves to observe these fish. And she says in this article, quote, "Whenever you would touch the surface of the water with your finger, a swarm of cavefish would come right up to it. Not many fish would do that. These cavefish have zero predators, so they're not afraid."
Oh, wow. That, you know, that reminds me of other examples we've talked about on the show, like various birds of the Galapagos Islands, for example. It reminds me of some stuff I was just reading the other day about the dodo bird, you know, where you have these organisms that adapt over evolutionary time to an environment where there are no predators or there is just an entirely different predation situation going on. And yeah, they just lose their fear. There's no need to engage in that kind of protective behavior because those things don't exist for them until they show up on a boat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking Dutch.
Okay. So that's lateral line sensations. And then the asymmetry of the skull, the kind of the circling behavior, all those differences. But there was one more thing I wanted to talk about. I mentioned in the previous episode, another sensory enhancement found in some of these cavefish. And that sensory enhancement was taste. It appeared to be involved in a pleiotropy. Remember, that's where a a single genetic change would result in multiple different changes in the phenotype, in the body or the behavior. And in this case, the idea was that there was a single genetic change that would result in both regression of the eyes. So this process we talked about where the eyes are sort of absorbed and the adult fish doesn't have eyes. And then along with that, development of a greater number of taste buds. Now, we speculated generally in the last episode that, yeah, you know, having enhanced other senses in a cave would probably be useful in some way. Taste buds are generally useful. They are our body's chemistry set to know what we're putting in the digestive tract. But I was wondering if there was anything else we could know about that. Like, how do these extra taste buds work in these fish? What kind of benefit do they provide? So this is another thing where the answer is not fully known yet. We know a few kind of interesting morsels. So I came across a very recent paper addressing this question. It was by Daniel Berning and Joshua B. Gross, published in Frontiers in Ecology and Evolution, 2023, called The Constructive Evolution of Taste in Astyanax Cavefish, a Review. And one of the things I thought was interesting here, Rob, I've attached a diagram for you to look at. It seems that mostly what we're talking about are what's called extraoral taste buds, taste buds that are not inside the mouth like ours, but outside the mouth and spread out over the jaws and the front of the face. So in this diagram, it shows blind cave fish from a couple of different populations compared to the surface variant with taste buds filled in as red dots on the illustrations. And while the surface variant looks like it is wearing lipstick, the red dots, the taste buds are on the mouth, the cave fish are wearing clown makeup. The taste buds are all over the face.
Yeah, it's quite impressive. And again, it makes sense for this kind of an environment. You know, you need to lean into a different sense situation. It reminds me a bit of our past discussions about catfish being super tasters, you know. And really, it come back to that situation where we have our human understanding of the senses, but we have a human-level understanding of those senses. And so when you're talking about something like this, that is enhanced. It's not taste as we know it. It's something different.
Yeah, exactly. So I was wondering, like, what do we know about what kind of difference this makes? What difference does it make in the lives of these fish? So there are a few things mentioned in this review. One is that multiple studies have found what appears to be enhanced sensitivity to chemical repellents and taste sources in the water. In the cave fish when compared to the surface fish. So just one example is a study by Humbach in 1960 that found in the cave fish compared to the common minnow that the modality for bitter sensation was 300 times more acute, roughly, and then the salty/acid/sweet modality difference was about 2,000 to 4,000 times more acute in the cave fish. So much greater, much lower, I guess, threshold of sensitivity to these tastes. Also, Protus et al. In 2008 found, quote, amino acids dissolved in system water were detected at a much lower concentration in Pachon cavefish. That's from one particular cave source. Pachon cavefish compared to surface fish. And one possible explanation the authors discuss for this heightened sensitivity to amino acids could be what they call the savory taste receptor T1R1. This is the receptor that binds to glutamate and helps us taste savory umami flavors. So I wonder if you could really get these cave fish going bananas over, something in the water, a piece of food or whatever is dispersed in the water, if you hit it with a bit of the good old MSG.
I bet. Or maybe one of those little fish-shaped soy containers.
Soy sauce. Yeah, we got some soy sauce, some Parmesan cheese, some tomatoes, some MSG, all the good savory things. However, the authors do say that several amino acids were used in the study that found this, so there could be other explanations, possibly also involving olfaction rather than taste. But anyway, what difference would these taste bud arrangements and heightened sensitivity to flavors make in terms of the behavior of the fish? The authors write, quote, "One recent study argued that external taste buds are used for preliminary assessment of food items during random swimming or targeted searches for food. Extraoral taste buds thus carry an importance for determining whether to pursue or avoid a food item." So the way I understand that is it's heightening the fish's foraging efficiency, basically, by saying before you even get something in the mouth, you're tasting the water around this thing with the front of your face, and it helps you zero in more quickly on something that is good to eat or is not good to eat. Like you're getting an idea about whether you're coming close to a good piece of food or not earlier. So that would make your foraging more efficient.
Okay, that makes sense.
In the end, however, they do say that that this is just an area that hasn't had enough research yet. They say that the, quote, "precise function of cavefish extraoral taste buds remains unclear and largely unexplored." And then they also say that future studies need to do things like excluding the role of olfaction or smell and isolating the variable of taste. And there are differences that even remain that they did examine in the paper that we just don't know how to explain yet, but could possibly be related to taste. One interesting idea they bring up is the feeding angle. So they say, you know, if you look at the cave variants of these fish versus the surface variants, one thing you will notice is that they both go along the bottom. There might be like a stony or sandy or pebbly bottom of the water source where they are. And they'll go along the bottom with their mouth down to the bottom, kind of searching for little bits of food to eat or, you know, prey in the case of, you know, carnivory or just little bits of dead organic matter, whatever it is they're coming across to eat. They're scouring the bottom for it. For some reason, the surface fish have a steeper angle that they forage at with their body more, it's almost more totally vertical, whereas the cave fish tend to forage at a more slanted angle that's closer, it's more like 55 degrees from the bottom versus more like 80 degrees in the surface variant. They say this could be related to the changes in extraoral taste buds. Maybe it's, you know, like they're tasting things differently, thus they have to orient their bodies differently. Don't know. But interesting question.
Yeah. I mean, this is fascinating to think about. Like, it makes one wonder if it has something to do with there being more predation opportunities for the surface fish. You know, like you've got to come in at that steeper angle because there's a greater risk of things, you know, on the floor of the sea or what have you that might come after them while they're feeding. And maybe those are absent in these cave environments. Again, you know, we're talking about like a lack of just biodiversity in those environments. You know, there are going to be fewer predators, et cetera. But who knows? That's just me spitballing.
I don't want to act like I just look at a diagram in a paper and answer the question. But just one thing I wonder about is looking again at the diagram of where these extraoral taste buds are in the surface fish. Remember, they're all like right at the mouth, but In the cave variant, a lot of them tend to be spread out along the lower jaw. So I wonder if it can come in at this shallower angle because it's sort of like feeling and tasting more along the bottom without having to get the front of its mouth in contact with it. It can kind of taste with the slope of its lower jaw.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense.
But yeah, again, don't know. Interesting questions about, usually when you think about fish and taste together, you're thinking about what a fish tastes like to you, not what it's like to taste as a fish.
Yeah, which again, it can put you in entirely different sense realities, especially considering things like a catfish, but also, you know, getting into taste and smell. Whenever I read information about, like, you know, the distances at which fish in the ocean can detect other things going on, say blood in the water or some sort of rotting tissue. I'm always just amazed because, again, it is an experience of the ocean that is just unlike anything we can experience when we venture into it.
Mm-hmm.
And the same holds true of the cave. Like when we enter into the cave, our experiences are rather different compared to the organisms that have evolved to thrive there.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Now, the place I'd like to turn to next, this gets into something that was probably one of the key reasons I decided this would be a good series for us to do, you know, to return to cave biology. This and the fact that I was also inspired by some cave environment-related stuff at the Bishop Museum on Oahu recently when I returned there and got to take in their natural history section in addition to their cultural and historical sections. This is the revelation that really pushed me over the edge, that for many cave environments, bat guano is sunlight.
Ooh.
Bat guano, that's bat poop, if you will, if you're not familiar. Essentially, in these environments, yes, this is the light of the sun. This it plays a vital role in the food chain. Because remember, light is the first step in the food chain of the epigean world. Sunlight reaches the surface where autotrophic organisms create food via sunlight, carbon dioxide, and water. These are autotrophs, and we call this the trophic level of the food chain.
Right. So, this came up in the last episode that almost all of the food chain we're really familiar with is happening where the base layer of the food chain is using energy from the sunlight to make its food. And then we, of course, you know, other organisms eat those organisms and on it goes. But if you don't have the sunlight to power the food synthesis at the base layer of the food chain, what do you do?
That's right. Yeah. Most of it depends on sunlight. Plants are autotrophs, as are seaweed, phytoplankton, some kinds of bacteria, including bacteria that produce their own food via chemosynthesis around volcanic vents. But most of the producers are producing their own food via the process of photosynthesis and therefore require the bounty of sunlight. The next trophic layer of the food chain is, of course, the primary consumers who eat the producers, the herbivores being chief among them. And then the predators compose the third trophic layer, the secondary consumers, followed by the tertiary consumers, and on up to the apex predators. And then you have, you know, you also have the other roles in there, the, you know, the scavengers, the decomposers, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as pointed out by Sequoy et al. In The Life Hidden Inside Caves, published 2020 in the International Journal of Ecology, cave ecosystems are intrinsically devoid of primary productivity due to the absence of light. Again, light may enter the opening of a cave to different degrees, and other caves may feature open areas or areas with sort of like naturally occurring skylights. But past those pools of light, there is only darkness, and that means, again, no photoautotrophic organisms.
Right, so this raises a question of how could there really be anything like an ecosystem inside a cave unless, I don't know, it was just like, unless things were coming and going from the outside to the inside constantly and eating each other in between, you know? How could there really be anything sustained within the cave purely in the dark?
And that's where bats enter the picture. We've, of course, talked about bats before. You have various species of bats that roost in cave environments and do so in vast numbers. So bat guano instead offers a major food source, a kind of alternate sunshine, brown sunshine, if you will, that falls upon the floor of caverns where insectivore or frugivorous bats roost. So yeah, bats that eat insects, bats that eat fruit. So we're talking about bat species that are generally nocturnal or crepuscular, that go out and feed and then return to the seclusion of their caves where they roost on the ceiling. And when they poop on the floor below them. And that poop brings in quite a few nutrients.
So it's not like the base, the photoautotroph layer outside, because in that case, it is that would be organisms that are fundamentally synthesizing chemical food energy out of what was originally inorganic sunlight energy. In this case, they are bringing energy in already in the form of chemical food energy and pooping it out on the floor, but it becomes like a new base layer of a food chain within the cave.
Exactly, yes. And I will also add, it is like sunlight in that you can replace the word sun or sunlight with bat guano in any song lyric, and it will work just as well. So please feel free to try that on your own time.
I'm walking on guano. Yeah.
It works perfectly.
Don't it feel good?
So this guano often serves as the primary renewable organic resource of these caves, and a whole food chain extends from this, supporting various bacteria, fungi, protists, and small arthropods. Now, according to Sequoy et al., the exact blend of nutrients is going to vary depending on broad category and specific species of bat. But the end result is that the fields of poop beneath the bats just become teeming with life. Life enough to support an ecosystem of organisms, including those visiting from the outside, other creatures that spend part of their time in the caves, and also, of course, obligate cave dwellers that are there all the time. Also, this was interesting, the fermentation of the biomass, along with the presence of all those warm-blooded bat colonies, actually heats up the caves.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, that's a difference that is acknowledged in some of the literature I've looked at, but we haven't really talked about much, which is a difference between cave environments and the surface is not only the lack of sunlight, but a much more constant temperature than you get on the surface. Though I guess this could be changed if, yeah, you're bringing in a lot of biomass and that's sort of like warming up the cavern.
Yeah, like at base level, it's like life in the wine cellar. But then if you get enough life in the wine cellar, well, things are going to have elevated temperatures, but still going to be pretty dependable, it sounds like. Though I guess you do have to factor in that there are, you know sometimes fluctuations in these, like the occupation by bats and so forth.
I do have to apologize. I'm only half following the conversation now because my brain is just running through song lyrics. Like, I've been waiting so long to be where I'm going in the guano of your love.
Yeah, guano on my shoulder. Yeah. Shoulders makes me happy, yeah. Yeah, I want to read a quote here from the Sequoy et al. Paper that gets into some of the details here of the guano. Quote, For example, small metazoans such as mites, pseudoscorpions, beetles, thrips, mites, and flies inhabit the guano of insectivorous bats, whereas the guano of frugivorous bats is frequented by spiders, mites, isopods, millipedes, centipedes, waders, bark lice, and insects. Salamander and cavefish populations and invertebrate communities also rely heavily on nutrients from the bat guano. They also point out that bat guano constitutes a niche of several varieties of microorganisms, including fungi, protists, lichen, viruses, and bacteria.
I wonder if the bat guano is primarily sweet or savory.
I guess we'd have to ask those blind cavefish from earlier.
Yeah, though, to be fair, in that quote, it just said that the cavefish populations rely on nutrients from bat guano. I don't know if that means they eat it directly or they eat other things that that eat it or whatever.
True, true. That is essential. And I believe that's something Sequoia et al. Point out is that there are organisms that depend on the guano that are not directly eating the guano, but they're able to thrive on the things that do consume and thrive on the guano directly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's also worth noting that the presence of the bats themselves also produces feeding opportunities for either scavengers or predators. I'm going to probably have more on this particular tidbit in the next episode. And another interesting thing that they point out is all of this can potentially change over time as well. You know, stable environments, but not necessarily, you know, eternal. Mm-hmm. I was reading a CBC radio story about a University of Ottawa study of bat guano in a specific Jamaican cave or cave system. I believe this cave is known as Home Away from Home Cave. It's very remote and has been a subject of some scientific study. And they were looking at it, and they were able to observe a shift over in the past from insect-eating bats to fruit-eating bats, though it was unclear as of 2021 if this was a change in diet by a specific species or perhaps more likely the influx of a different bat species that had a different diet. They also found increased guano levels of cadmium, mercury, lead, and zinc present during the same time as the Industrial Revolution. So they were getting into, like, you know, we can see this change. We can see this environmental change brought on by the Industrial Revolution in the guano of these bats in this remote Jamaican cave.
Heavy metal guano.
Yeah. Now, of course, we have various other creatures besides the bat, but also from the era of bats to consider that are now extinct, that would have entered into caves and would have defecated. We have like the cave bear that is extinct, the extinct cave hyena. Coprolites from both of these species, fossilized fecal matter, has been discovered in caves.
Yeah.
Now, another tidbit, and this is something you could definitely go in deeper on. We could come back to in another episode in the future at some point. Sequoia et al. Point out that the other thing about bat guano is that human beings figured out that, hey, this stuff has value. So cave environments have also long been exploited by human beings due to its economic value as a fertilizer. And also, for at least for a while there, it was harvested to produce gunpowder. And all of this can impact these cave environments.
Mm.
Here's another interesting thing. The bats that enter into these caves are... they are not set in stone. They are changing. We just discussed how these caves form over geologic time in the first episode. But the bats, by roosting in the caves, physically change them, roosting on the ceiling with their little claws. So that physically changes the cave. And then also there's chemical augmentation of the caves via their urination because, they're going both number one and number two in that cave system, and it does have an impact.
Oh, do you know if the urination, does it primarily like build structures or dissolve parts of the cave?
I believe it is more dissolving. Yeah.
Okay.
And again, we're dealing often with limestone cave systems and so forth. So that's my understanding here. Because I know what you're thinking. Do we end up with actual
bat pea stalagmites?
Yeah, bat pea stalagmites. Yeah. I do not have an answer to that, but I think it is more of a dissolving of the cave system that is in play here.
Wait a minute. Hold on. I just Googled bat pea stalagmites. With large numbers of bats, thick and hard stalactites and stalagmites of crystallized bat urine occasionally form.
Well, there you go. Okay, so that is also possible. It's just a wonderful world down there. It's a whole new world.
Sorry, I should say, since I read that directly, that was from something called the Internet Center for Wildlife Damage Management. Don't know what that is, but that's what they claim.
Yeah, there was another, I didn't get into this article a lot. Maybe I could come back more in the next episode, but there was a 2021 article in the New York Times titled How Bats and Their Poop Erase Ancient Cave Art. And that one got into this issue of it, because again, they're changing the caves. And sometimes that can change things that prehistoric humans did. They point out that large quantities of the urine and the guano, it ferments, it can saturate the air with, quote, aerosolized particles of phosphoric acid. So it's a rich world down there.
Mm.
Goodbye, horse doodle. Now, an interesting and largely unanswered question for me, I was able to get some answers on it, pertains to the question, what might cave environments have been like before the evolution of cave roosting bats?
Oh.
Because again, bats are mammals, and mammals have not, and they're highly successful mammals. They've been around for a while, but they haven't always been around. So what would have potentially pooped up these caves and sustained these ecosystems before bats?
That's a good point. So if like the base layer of the food web within the cave is emerging from bat guano, and there were at a time no bats to bring the guano in, could there be an ecosystem in the cave at all?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think by and large, the answer is yes, there would have been things that have done that.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that in part because even today, bats are not the only trogs to poop in a cave. They are considerable factors, but crickets are often brought up as another major cave pooper that allows the sun to shine in these lightless places.
Mm-hmm.
So it would seem that pre-bat organisms would have taken advantage of the cave niche to do, to whatever degree they could. Though one of the things about investigations into cave fossils is that fossils that you find in deep caves aren't necessarily telling you about subterranean life. Tracks in the floor or even ceilings of deep caves may actually be insightful about life along shorelines of the surface. That's the degree of time that we're dealing with and considering the likes of, for instance, a 500 meter deep, that's a third of a mile deep cavern in France. I was reading about this is, and I may be butchering French here, likely am, Castelbock cave. Here, for instance, you'll find dino footprints that were first etched in mud or sand on a beach 100 million years ago, and they've just been gradually forced underground over time.
Mm-hmm. So it's not like they were formed in the cave. These are rocks that that were formed on the surface, and then they later emerged in a cave.
Yeah, and kind of similar to like, oh, you can't find a trilobite on a mountain and be like, these were the mountain trilobites. Like, no, yeah. It's not really what's happening. But of course, this doesn't mean we don't have evidence of dinosaur age cave dwellers. As reported in by Nature in 2020, cockroaches preserved in amber from 99 million years ago are likely the oldest evidence we have of organisms evolved for life in a cave environment.
100 million year old cave cockroaches. What were they like?
Oh, they were kind of scary. I included an image here of one for you, Joe. This is one of the species that they were looking at. And you'll see that it has front appendages, these kind of like raptorial forelegs, much like mm-hmm. a praying mantis,
yeah.
Which means they were likely a highly predatory species in their cave environments.
Hmm.
So that's one of the features that they found on these amber-preserved specimens. There's lost coloration. There's reduced wing and eye size, elongated antennae, and reduced leg spines for passive defense. So two species were discovered in amber in this cave from Myanmar, one of which apparently had these raptorial forelegs, meaning it was likely primarily a predator. And according to a paper in Cosmos magazine by James Urquhart, one of the interesting things about this find is that the specimens in question would seem to have mid-Cretaceous origins, but all cave animals living today have a late Cenozoic origin. Now, why these older cave organisms died out is apparently a mystery, because it would seem like an ideal place to shelter and survive surface world extinction events. But obviously, that's not the case. The article also stresses that it's not impossible that these cockroaches may have survived even into modern times in one form or another, because our understanding of living insects is, of course, incomplete. So it's not impossible that that even though we're gazing backwards through time with this particular specimen, its genetic legacy could still be alive today.
Mm.
The article here is quite good. It also stresses some of the larger challenges of understanding such ancient cave environments and figuring out what they consisted of. Other Mesozoic cave organisms certainly existed, but either we get into the same problems we encounter with the inherent incompleteness of fossils in general and the fossil mm-hmm. record, because either a cave system collapsed long ago or, key to this example, didn't allow fossil preservation. This case, amber containing cave organisms, is rather unique because a tree is not going to grow in said cave.
Yeah,
they say this is kind of like a one in a million find, because it probably depended on resin from a tree growing directly in the mouth of a cave, like in exactly the right place, exactly the right time, in order to capture this creature that otherwise would not be venturing out of the caves to climb around on trees.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I was wondering, I was going to ask about exactly that. Like, how does a cave cockroach get trapped in amber? So I guess the answer is probably very rarely happened. We're incredibly lucky to have this unique find.
Yeah, and it just raises the question, like, what else would have been down there that didn't crawl into the amber? You know, there's again, just so many mysteries within the fossil record. And back to the earlier point, so many mysteries remaining in just sort of the existing organic world. You know, we're still making discoveries regarding insects, cave environments, cave ecosystems. It's really exciting.
No doubt. And you know what? I think we're going to have to end today's episode there, but we've got more cave stuff to talk about. So we're going to be back with part three, definitely.
That's right. We're going to get into some cave predators and who knows what else. All right. Stuff to blow your mind. As you know, core episodes are on Tuesdays and Thursday. We're primarily a science and culture podcast. And then on Mondays, we do listener mail. On Wednesdays, we do a short form episode. And then on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird film. On Weird House Cinema, we bust out a rerun on the weekends.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.